content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello again, this is Randall Rickman from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Our current edition is a double issue dated not only February 18th, but also February 25th, 2019. So this reading will count for 2 weeks of Time Magazine. Feel free to revisit and play it again if you'd like. We certainly would welcome you doing that. The cover story on this edition, The Art of Optimism. And we'll go right into the beginning of the magazine. The regular feature called For the Record is first. That is a one-page collection of tiny news items, each one illustrated with a line drawing or a headline in bold or a combination of the two. In the right upper right corner of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic in red 34. Caption explains, distance in miles that the magnetic North Pole has been moving on average each year since 2000. Quote, erratic, unquote, magnetic field shifts prompted the National Centers for Environmental Information to release a February 4th update to its models. In the lower right margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Randy Zuckerberg, entrepreneur, in a February 4th CNN interview about leaving Facebook, which was co-founded by her brother, Mark, to start her own company. And the quotation from Randy Zuckerberg, entrepreneur, quote, my best advice for young women in tech is to have a man's name like Randy, unquote. And for clarification, Randy Zuckerberg's Randy is spelled R-A-N-D-I. In the lower right corner of the page is the feature within a feature, Bad Week, Good Week. At Bad Week, condo. Manhattan condo sales declined 4 of the past 5 years. Under Good Week, condo, spelled with a K. Tidying expert Marie Kondo's Netflix show sparks such a junk-clearing surge that thrift stores set donation limits. That's condo with a K. Running along the lower left bottom of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Stacey Abrams, former minority leader for the Georgia House of Representatives, in the Democratic Party rebuttal to President Trump's February 5th State of the Union address. And the quotation from Stacey Abrams, quote, compassionate treatment at the border is not the same as open borders, unquote. In the middle left margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Taro Aso, Japan's 78-year-old deputy prime minister, on the country's aging population at a February 3rd event. And the quotation from Taro Aso, Japan's deputy prime minister, quote, there are lots of strange people who say the elderly people are to blame, but that is wrong. The problem is those who don't have children, unquote. Caption goes on to say, he later retracted the comment and apologized, quote, to some, unquote, who were offended. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Donald Trump, U.S. president, after CBS News asked whether he would let his 12-year-old son, Barron, play football in an interview that aired on Super Bowl Sunday. And the quote from U.S. President Donald Trump in red, quote, it's a dangerous sport. I would have a hard time with it, unquote. In the upper middle of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Pope Francis on the second-class status of women around the world, having acknowledged for the first time on February 5th that sexual abuse of nuns by clergymen is a problem within the Catholic Church. The quotation from Pope Francis in all black and all caps, quote, "I dare say that humanity hasn't matured," unquote. And finally, in the lower middle of the page, is a story illustrated by the statistic in bright red, 52. Caption explains, number of consecutive hours below 0 degrees Fahrenheit in Chicago during the last week of January, the Windy City's fourth longest such streak since 1930. That was the entire content of the For the Record page. That leads us now to the major section that begins the magazine, The Brief. And first up in The Brief is Opener. And the subsection is Law Enforcement, where the headline is Dealing with Drugs Beyond El Chapo, by Melissa Chan. Two brazen prison escapes is a lot for a jury to look past. But in closing arguments at the federal trial of the world's most famous accused drug lord, his lawyer pleaded with jurors to do just that. Look past the notorious nickname and headline-grabbing revelations of the trial, he implored in a voice first booming, then softening. And see the man, Joaquin Guzman, rather than, quote, the myth of El Chapo, unquote. But by the time jurors began deliberation on February 4th, government prosecutors had put forth what they called an, quote, avalanche of evidence, unquote, that Guzman, who had been facing the possibility of life in an American prison since his trial began in Brooklyn in November, deserved his infamy. Across 3 months, prosecutors had laid out text messages, audio recordings, and dozens of testimonies, painting Guzman as a serial philanderer and a murderous cartel kingpin who regularly resorted to violence to defend his stake in the multi-billion-dollar Sinaloa cartel. Quote, do not let him escape responsibility, unquote, Assistant U.S. Attorney Andrea Goldberg said, alluding to the prison escapes by laundry cart and tunnel that made Guzman a household name in the U.S. even before his 2017 extradition. Quote, hold him accountable for his crimes, unquote. And yet, U.S. authorities are among those eager to look past the El Chapo myth, if in a different way than defense lawyers ask. The drug business may hold a lure to show business. The actor Alejandro Eda, who portrays Guzman in Netflix's Narcos Mexico, showed up in the gallery one day. But the trial methodically laid out the reality of how a massive criminal enterprise is run on a daily basis. A witness testified that in 2008, Guzman commissioned an encrypted communication network for use by members of his inner circle. The Colombian IT specialist who built the network flipped, giving U.S. authorities key access to the entire system. A dozen of the 56 prosecution witnesses were admitted criminals, many of them among Guzman's closest confidants, who had struck deals in hopes of shortening their own prison sentences. The defense team made much of this tactic. Prosecutors, for their part, made clear that the pursuit of justice was a far greater challenge south of the border. Cooperating witnesses described how the cartel breached the highest levels of the Mexican government and its police force. One of the most damning allegations to emerge was the claim that Guzman paid former Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto $100 million to stop looking for him while he was on the lam. Peña Nieto's former chief of staff has vigorously denied the claim. U.S. law enforcement agents also told jurors how corruption hindered previous efforts to capture Guzman and other cartel leaders. U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, parenthetically DEA, agent Victor Vasquez testified that the 2014 mission to recapture Guzman in Mazatlan, Mexico, worked only because it was kept secret from the local police, who experience warned might tip off the targets of raids. Quote, using them again, unquote, he said, quote, was not going to work, unquote. A trial is always a show. On any typical day during El Chapo's, dozens of journalists and tourists lined up in the courthouse lobby before 7 a.m. to vie for seats. Guzman would enter with a wave to his wife, Emma Coronel Aspuro, then shake hands with his attorneys. But for all the attention, researchers say it's unclear that taking down any individual kingpin does much to impact the illegal drug trade, fueled by relentless demand in America. Other criminals step up to take over vacant roles, and the period of instability often triggers more violence. Yet law enforcement presses on. The DEA's latest National Drug Threat Assessment says Mexican criminal enterprises, like the Sinaloa cartel, pose the greatest illegal drug threat to the U.S. Guzman's trial presented much evidence of his skill at finding new ways to get drugs across the border. By plane, train, automobile, submarine, tunnel, and even allegedly in cans of jalapeno peppers. The merits of President Trump's border wall went unaddressed. On the Mexican side, meanwhile, a new president has announced a new approach, one driven by revulsion at the extraordinary bloodshed associated with the drug trade. In 2018, Mexican officials opened 33,341 murder investigations, a 33% increase over the prior year, and a new high. On January 30th, the very day prosecutors gave their closing arguments in the El Chapo trial, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador declared an end to his country's war on drugs, saying he would no longer prioritize capturing cartel bosses in hopes of breaking the cycle of violence. Quote, arresting them is not our main purpose, unquote, said López Obrador. Quote, the main purpose of the government is to guarantee public safety, unquote. López Obrador, a leftist elected in July by the largest margin in Mexico's modern history, vowed instead to address the root causes of crime. Quote, hugs, not gunshots, unquote, and, quote, you can't fight fire with fire, unquote, were among his campaign's slogans. There are plenty of skeptics, but the trial of El Chapo, full of revelations as it was, offered few options for a different path forward. Entire article by Melissa Chan. Still in the brief, the facing page has the mini feature called The Bulletin, where the headline is, On Historic Trip, Pope Francis Tries to Bridge Gulfs. Article by Billy Perigo, who writes, The first ever papal visit to the Arabian Peninsula the birthplace of Islam, was meant to build bridges between faiths. But shortly after Pope Francis touched down in Abu Dhabi, the capital of the United Arab Emirates, on February 3rd, he made the visit about more than just religion. The UAE is a member of the Saudi-led coalition that has been bombing Yemen since 2015, part of a campaign that the U.S. supports and that the Vatican has criticized. Francis risked his host's displeasure to make a public point about the crisis in Yemen. And here, author Billy Perigo names three items. First item, good relations. For Pope Francis, who began his papacy by taking strides to improve interfaith dialogue, the historic visit was a chance to cement ties with Islamic leaders. Together with an influential imam, he signed a, quote, document on human fraternity, unquote, on February 4th, which calls for believers to, quote, refrain from using the name of God to justify acts of murder, exile, terrorism, and oppression, unquote. The church hopes better relations will improve the fate of persecuted Christians around the world. Second item, past protest. Before landing in Abu Dhabi, Francis issued his strongest condemnation yet of the violence in Yemen. Quote, many children are suffering from hunger but cannot access food depots, unquote, he said, urging fighters to respect a ceasefire and allow aid convoys through. The UN says the war has caused the worst humanitarian crisis in the world today, contributing to a cholera outbreak and tens of thousands of deaths. Third item, balancing act. Even as the UAE has proclaimed 2019 a, quote, year of tolerance, unquote, and taken steps to remove barriers to the public worship of religions other than Islam, the state has cracked down on dissenters, including critics of the war. But when Francis made tolerance his topic in a February 4th speech, he said that religious people have a duty to reject war and its, quote, fateful consequences, unquote, adding that he was, quote, thinking in particular of Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and Libya, unquote. In using the language of faith to discuss Yemen, Francis bridged another gap that the UAE has tried to preserve, the one between politics and religion. Entire article by Billy Perigo. That brings us to the regular sidebar feature, News Ticker, a collection of three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, protests erupt after Brooklyn jail loses heat. Crowds gathered outside the Brooklyn Metropolitan Detention Center over the course of a week, during which the facility largely went without power and heat as temperatures dropped into the single digits. A federal judge visited to investigate conditions after power was restored on February 3rd. Middle item, rival peace talks rile Afghanistan. Afghanistan's president, Ashraf Ghani, criticized dozens of political and social leaders who took part in talks with the Taliban without him in Moscow on February 5th, a week after U.S. talks with the group produced a draft deal to end the 18-year war. Ghani said those involved had, quote, no executive authority, unquote. Final item, feds subpoena inauguration records. Federal prosecutors on February 4th ordered President Trump's inaugural committee to turn over documents related to donors, finances, and more. and a sign of an expanding criminal investigation. The subpoena shows prosecutors are looking into potential fraud and money laundering by the group, which raised $106.7 million. Moving ahead, and still in the brief, we're now in the section called News. And the subsection is Good Question by Philip Elliott. The headline is, What does it take to force a politician to resign these days? Ralph Northam's career looked cooked. On February 1st, Virginians learned that their governor's 1984 medical school yearbook page included a picture of a person in blackface alongside another in a Ku Klux Klan-style robe and hood. Within hours, everyone from local legislators to the chairman of the Democratic National Committee had called on Northam to resign. But as political junkies counted the minutes until the Democrats' exit, Northam did something few anticipated. He apologized for the photo, denied he was in it, and refused to quit. Even as the party struggled to understand the impact of that surprise, a separate allegation emerged about Northam's would-be successor, Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax. California political science professor Vanessa Tyson claimed that Fairfax had sexually assaulted her in 2004. Fairfax immediately denied the charges, describing them as a, quote, smear, unquote, perpetrated by political rivals. And on February 6th, the third in line to the job, Attorney General Mark Herring, disclosed that he, too, had donned blackface in 1980. If all three go without appointing another successor, a Republican would become governor. The cascade highlighted how changing norms are posing new challenges for politicians and their parties. Heightened awareness of racial inequality is casting once-overlooked bigoted behavior in a new light. And the Me Too movement is giving women courage to say they were victims of assault at the hands of men whose earlier denials would have gone unchallenged. The events also showed how today's mercurial media will shape the 2020 cycle's inevitable political flare-ups. On the one hand, the high-speed news cycle accelerates fringe posts into the mainstream. Both the Northam photo and the Fairfax allegation were first reported by a right-wing website. On the other, the same news pace can shorten the danger zone for an accused politician. Hunkered down in Richmond, Northam might be looking at the GOP for lessons on how to survive. Some Republicans call for then-candidate Donald Trump to leave the 2016 ticket after he was heard bragging of groping women on a decade-old tape that emerged in October 2016. He declined and went on to win the presidency a month later. When sexual assault allegations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh surfaced last year, he looked doomed. He forcefully denied them. GOP senators stood by him. He now stands to shape the country for a generation. A majority of Senate Democrats, by contrast, exiled Minnesota Senator Al Franken in late 2017 in the wake of sexual misconduct allegations. Unlike Trump, Franken acquiesced, which many Democrats now regret. So where are the new lines drawn? No one knows. But the slate of potential Democratic challengers to Trump is already filled with a diverse group of candidates intent on elevating gender and racial justice to the fore. As for Northam, he seems to think a dose of defiance, and voters' fleeting attention span may spare him. After all, Trump is in the White House. Article by Philip Elliott. And moving ahead, still in the brief, we're now at the major section called Time With. And this time, it's Time With Chef Sandra Lee. Time says, Sandra Lee has risen to fame on Will, Charm, and Cool Whip. Now she's taking on cancer. Article by Belinda Luscombe. Sandra Lee, the creator of the semi-homemade brand of cookbooks, magazines, and TV shows, and a person who leaves nothing to chance, is sitting in a high-ceilinged ballroom on Wall Street on a rainy evening the weekend after Thanksgiving, listening to a local official present her with a tribute. But sincere as the speech is, it cannot be heard over the chatter of the members of the New York City independent film community who have turned out for the IFP Gotham Awards. This is not Lee's usual audience. To New York's indie film elite, she is that woman who rose to fame on her ability to gussy up ready-made food into something that feels like home-cooked dinner on the Food Network. Rachel Weisz, Glenn Close, and Ethan Hawke are among the assembled throng. It's probably more of a Padma Lakshmi crowd. Still, when Lee rises to give her acceptance speech, the room falls quiet. Lee, 52, is being honored with a Made in New York award for her film RX Early Detection, A Cancer Journey with Sandra Lee, an HBO documentary in which she chronicled her 2015 treatment for breast cancer. It's a brave film in that it lets viewers see many of the more gory parts of getting a double mastectomy and some of the less glorious parts of being Sandra Lee. That she can work this room, indeed, that she is even in this room, is testament to Lee's unlikely journey from marketer of do-it-yourself home decor to award-winning TV host and author of 27 books to politically connected health advocate. I'll repeat that sentence for clarity, with apologies. That she can work this room, indeed, that she is even in this room, is testament to Lee's unlikely journey from marketer of do-it-yourself home decor to award-winning TV host and author of 27 books to politically connected health advocate. In a way few can manage, Lee has lived her brand. Just as she once transformed ice cream, cocoa, Cool Whip, and store-bought lemon icing into a baked potato-shaped dessert, she has scraped together whatever she had and, with a little prettying up and a lot of will, made it look extraordinary. The particular award Lee is receiving, for example, is given out by the New York City Mayor's Office. Interestingly, Lee is the longtime girlfriend of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who was the long-term bête noir of the city's current mayor, Bill de Blasio. So, as well as being a nod to her willingness to take on a tough subject, parenthetically, she funded the film herself, the honor speaks to Lee's ability to use to her advantage circumstances that would seem to many to be deeply unfavorable. Perhaps most of all, her presence at the awards is also evidence of Lee's unassailable congeniality. The first girlfriend of New York, as she jokes about being called, has many critics. Her style of cooking is a favorite target of the internet mockosphere. Parenthetically, feel free to Google Kwanzaa cake, for example. But very few people, no matter their feelings for Lee, the chef, or Lee, the award recipient, can withstand the force of Lee, the friendly person. Take the subject line of her email to set up the first meeting with a reporter from a national news weekly. Quote, "Are you my date, dear?" Unquote. This is a divorced ex-convert to Judaism living with a divorced Catholic who has been personally blessed by the Pope twice. This is a woman who got Florence Henderson of Brady Bunch fame to sell her wares on infomercials after Henderson's agent turned her down three times. Quote, "I told her what I wanted to do and how I wanted to do it," unquote, says Lee of Her Big Break. Quote, "And I said, this is how much money I have left, and I'll give all of it to you if you please help me," unquote. According to acknowledgments at the end of her documentary, Elton John and Bono helped her out. Lee makes friends the way Raytheon makes missiles, expertly and with precision aim. Her greatest asset may be her ability to make people feel instantly that she's 100% on their side. She's immediately intimate, sharing more vulnerability than a new relationship might warrant, and quick to offer advice, sympathy, or the name of someone who can do something. Quote, "I'm the help," unquote, Lee says, a week or so after the awards. Sitting in the lobby of the apartment building / hotel she stays in while in Manhattan. Quote, "I'm like, what do your kids need? What can I do for you?" Unquote. We're moving on. There is much more in this article, but we move on to include more from this double issue. Before we leave, we will include part of a mini metric in the middle of the article. It's a sidebar feature, which actually is in the middle of the page, called Lee Quick Facts. And there are three of them. Top fact, prolific producer. Lee has published 27 books and produced 15 TV seasons in the semi-homemade series. Middle item, aggressive treatment. A preemptive double mastectomy for her form of cancer is unusual, but Lee wanted to avoid radiation and chemo and reduce the risk of recurrence. Final item, first birds. Lee has two cockatoos, one of whom, Phoenix, is house-trained and flies freely around her home in Westchester County, New York. Also, before we leave the article, there is a feature quotation out of a paragraph in red, and the quotation is from Sandra Lee on her desire to be helpful to the people in her life. Quote, in red, "I'm the help. I'm like, what do your kids need? What can I do for you?" Unquote. Moving ahead, and we are now in the next section called The View. And the subsection leading off is politics, and the headline is The Attention Election by Nancy Gibbs. As the presidential rollouts begin, the contenders will tell us what to expect of them, as they calculate what to expect of us. What will it take to capture our imagination and, even more urgent, our attention? Donald Trump has shaped that test for all who hope to succeed him, and we're about to find out what that means. Here comes as diverse and intriguing a crop of contenders as we've seen in years. But when a perfectly worthy candidate like former Mayor Julian Castro talks about how, quote, "I have a strong vision for the country's future," unquote, or Senator Kirsten Gillibrand tells Stephen Colbert that, quote, "I would bring people together to start getting things done," unquote, or Senator Elizabeth Warren stands in front of her microwave only to invoke those who, quote, work hard and play by the rules, unquote, my attention wanders. We've now lived with prolonged exposure to constant shock, to the adrenaline jolt of hearing something we never thought we'd hear from a public figure, whether about trade or tariffs or women or walls. It makes me wonder whether Trump has so accustomed us to surprise that any script, however sincere, sounds phony and forced. Before they can start talking about vital needs or fresh ideas, candidates have to persuade us to listen. That task has perhaps never been harder, and not because we don't care. We may just no longer know how. Elections have consequences, so do campaigns, and Trump's never actually stopped. Unlike his predecessors, he saw no need to shift from running to serving, never moved past the performance art of his massive rallies where he could repeat the same outlandish promises over and over, thrilling the crowds, appalling fact-checkers, confounding his adversaries. The universe of political discourse swelled, crashing through boundaries of truth, tradition, and at times decency. The audience grew, too, as people never much interested in politics were drawn to the dazzle. Meanwhile, traditional gatekeepers have found themselves at a loss for how to react, other than to overreact, overread messages, overplay hands. Shared stupefaction binds us like an audience at a horror movie, our lizard brains alight. Trump is not responsible for our attention economy. He has just got in early and looked to corner the market. All this had been a long time coming, the technologies hooking us on cheap and constant stimulus, our reflective reflexes weakening to the point that the last remaining political sin is now uncertainty. Our political conversations have become not just dismal and mean, but also way too focused on the combat instead of the context. Like, which problems most need solving? Who has the best solution? And whether there is enough common sense left anywhere to find common ground. The Democrats in the midterms showed great discipline and saw great success by focusing on health care and economic fairness and all but ignoring the president. But that is harder when someone takes aim. I'll repeat that. But that is harder when someone takes him on one-on-one. Senator Kamala Harris also drew huge at this stage crowds and donations while gesturing in this direction. The president's only working pronoun is the first person singular. She made hers plural with her admonition that, quote, we are better than this, unquote. Before 2020 arrives, we'll quickly get a sense of who can succeed on the field Trump has created, or who can even build a new one. While agile social media technique may not be the same as governing, it is now a necessary part of leadership. Hence the glow emanating from the coverage of a rookie member of Congress like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, whose dominant use of social media has taught a world of wonks how to inject a debate over marginal tax rates into the political bloodstream. Even her name has proved too cumbersome for this restless age, now compressed to AOC, a JFK for the Twitterati. Time is not money. Attention is. It will be telling to see how many people use every new tool and tactic that technology and even Trump has delivered unto us. Not to divert and divide, but to shape a more honest, more subtle, more substantial campaign than the last one. We know how easily we can be distracted. I'm counting on the candidates to show us how we can be healed. That was the entire article by Nancy Gibbs. And Time says Gibbs, a former editor-in-chief of Time, is the visiting Edward R. Murrow Professor at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Sharing this page is a recurring sidebar feature called Short Reads. Time's caption explains highlights from stories on time.com/ideas. And there are three listed, top to bottom. And top item, a better taxation formulation. University of Chicago law professor Daniel Hamel argues that Senator Elizabeth Warren's proposed wealth tax on the super rich targets the right problem, the wealth gap, but is the wrong solution. Hamel writes that fixing the income tax code would be easier both to enforce and to have the Supreme Court uphold. Middle item, work stress solutions. For those who struggle with negative thinking at the office, No Hard Feelings authors Liz Fazalian and Molly West Duffy have some advice. One tip is to remind yourself, quote, a tiny mistake is unlikely to start a chain reaction that ends in complete disaster, unquote. And, for clarity, the title of that book entitled is No Hard Feelings. The authors are Liz Fazalian and Molly West Duffy. No Hard Feelings. The bottom item, what industry can't fix? Quote, we should rid ourselves of the belief that business innovation inherently means social progress, unquote, argues Winnie Bianmia, executive director of Oxfam International. She urges companies to see, quote, their short-term gains are also their long-term losses in inequality, political dysfunction, and social polarization, unquote. On the facing page, the regular feature called the Risk Report. And the headline is, the end of a U.S.-Russia arms treaty spells long-term trouble, by Ian Bremmer. Some foreign policy decisions fundamentally reshape the world as we know it in an instant. Others take years for their full impact to be felt. The Trump administration's decision on February 1st to withdraw the U.S. from the Cold War-era Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces, parenthetically INF, treaty, is in the second category. The threat of nuclear war has not subtly spiked because the U.S. decided to quit the INF treaty, nor because the Kremlin announced its intention to follow suit 24 hours later. But make no mistake, this is a decision from Washington that makes the world a more competitive, combustible place in the long term. There's little question that Moscow indeed violated the terms of the agreement signed in 1987 by Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev. As tensions were rising over Ukraine, back in 2014, Russia deployed a type of missile that the INF treaty was supposed to ban. Then-President Barack Obama even wrote a letter to Russian President Vladimir Putin to that effect. So it was in the spirit of trying to keep the treaty intact rather than break it completely. The plea fell on deaf ears. 5 years later, the Trump administration scrapped the deal altogether. From a certain angle, the decision looks eminently reasonable. What good is a treaty if one of the signatories refuses to adhere to it. But in geopolitics, as in life, context matters. The Europeans have long known that the Russians weren't living up to the terms of the INF Treaty. In an era of stronger U.S.-EU relations, there might have been coordination between Washington and Brussels on how to get the Russians to respect the terms of the deal, rather than the U.S. deciding to do away with it altogether. As it stands, Washington's decision to walk away from the INF Treaty, despite strident European objections, is yet another sign to European leaders that the U.S. can no longer be counted on as a dependable partner. Then there is China. Right now, relations between Beijing and Moscow remain relatively strong, while Beijing and Washington duke it out over trade. The Chinese supported the INF Treaty, if for no other reason than it meant they could build up a credible military arsenal in relative peace, while both the U.S. and Russia watched from the sidelines. Now China needs to worry about a possible missile buildup on the 2,615-mile border it shares with Russia, in addition to any possible deployment of U.S. missiles in Asia that the INF Treaty prohibited. And while it's unlikely that the INF withdrawal will have much bearing on the U.S.-China trade war negotiations currently unfolding, it adds fuel to the narrative that the U.S. and China are on a slow march toward collision. But the most serious risk in the wake of the INF pullout is the continued deterioration of the U.S.-Russia relationship. Despite the apparent chumminess between President Donald Trump and Putin, issues like Ukraine, Syria, election interference, cyber operations, and NATO expansion all continue to push the two sides toward conflict. Already, Russia's defense ministry has said it will develop new land-based missile systems, which were forbidden under the pact. The INF Treaty, and arms control more generally, was one potential area of collaboration for Washington and Moscow to work together and make the world a safer place. Now it's yet one more point of tension, and as more developments from Robert Mueller's investigation make their way into the headlines, the last thing the world needs is more points of friction between Washington and Moscow. Entire article by Ian Bremmer. And moving ahead, and we now find ourselves in the section of The View called Ideas, where the headline is Howard Schultz's Bigger Problems. Article by Ralph Nader. Caption explains, Nader, a consumer advocate, ran for president four times and is the author of How the Rats Reformed the Congress. Ralph Nader writes, by even just testing the waters for an independent presidential run in 2020, billionaire former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz has done us a favor. He has revealed the political bigotry inherent in the torrent of spoiler charges immediately leveled at him by Democratic Party partisans and scores of pundits, including supposed champions of the free speech rights of very unpopular opinions, who claim he will swing the 2020 election to President Trump. Never mind Schultz's right to free speech, petition, and assembly. In my presidential campaigns, all the media wanted was my reaction to the spoiler charge. It didn't matter that I worked on overdue reforms, mostly supported by a majority of the public. It didn't matter that these initiatives had been taken off the table by the two major parties. The label will surely plague Schulz, too, even after he clarified on February 4th, quote, I promise I would do nothing whatsoever to be a spoiler to re-elect Donald Trump, unquote. But the term has also been a distraction from a deeper strategic issue, Schulz's inclination to run as an independent candidate. Calling himself a, quote, lifelong Democrat, unquote, the coffee magnate advances views that he dubiously calls, quote, centrist, unquote, but that decidedly reflect his plutocratic class. His business practices were anti-labor. He is anti-higher taxes on the wealthy, anti-Medicare for all, anti-tuition-free higher education, anti-government employer of last resort, and anti-Social Security protection. He calls these measures, quote, extreme, unquote, unaffordable, unquote, and even, quote, not American, unquote. He frets deeply about growing federal deficits without distinguishing that those come from corporate welfare, parenthetically, which Starbucks has received, and the massive Trump tax cuts, parenthetically, which Schulz has denounced, in contrast to deficits from infrastructure capital investments that generate GDP growth and efficiencies. For clarification, your reader will repeat that line without the parentheticals. He frets deeply about growing federal deficits without distinguishing those that come from corporate welfare and the massive Trump tax cuts, in contrast to deficits from infrastructure capital investments that generate GDP growth and efficiencies. He praises Ronald Reagan and calls Trump, quote, unqualified, unquote. Yes, he wants to stay in the Paris Climate Accord, and he has a more open stance on immigration than Trump, but moderate Republican voters share those views as well. Howard Schulz's agenda is simply far closer to the GOP's agenda. He would be better off registering as a Republican and challenging President Trump inside the party primaries, where he would receive massive visibility. Currently, Schulz is testing his dream theory that many people in the Republican and Democratic parties bridle at their party's polar extremes. Enough such voters can, in Schulz's view, be joined with truly up-for-grabs independent voters to give him the edge in a three-way race. He will soon be disabused. Independent candidate Ross Perot received more than 19 million votes in 1992 and briefly led the polls in that three-way race. He received not one Electoral College vote. It is very doubtful that the less evocative Schulz will come close to Perot's total, disadvantaged as he will be by the same winner-take-all system and even higher hurdles to get in the two-party-controlled presidential debates. Parenthetically, Perot managed to overcome the latter. In no other Western democracy is it remotely as difficult for candidates to get on the ballot and give more choices and voices to the voters. Third-party suppression is an American specialty, one I've experienced firsthand. What is tragic is that this creates a pattern, since independent or third-party candidates do not have a chance to win. The media don't give them the coverage needed to compete and grow, even when they actually represent a majority of American beliefs. It is a vicious cycle. It once was easier to get on the ballot. A series of pioneering parties started in 1840 with the Liberty Party, which demanded the abolition of slavery. Later, the populist, progressive, and other parties pressed for women's suffrage, labor rights, regulation of big business, progressive taxation, the 40-hour work week, health insurance, Social Security, and electoral reforms. Not a single one won a national election, but their voters led the way on policies that the major parties eventually adopted. Schulz is no revolutionary. Oppose or support him as you wish, but do not demand he stay out or drop out and still call yourself a small d Democrat. Ultimately, it's the voter's fundamental right to choose. I'll read that line with the more proper emphasis. Ultimately, it's the voter's fundamental right to choose. That was the entire article by Ralph Nader. And that brings us to the end of another edition of Time Magazine. And this happened to be a double issue, so it will do us for 2 weeks' time. This is your reader, Randall Rickman. Thank you once again for joining us. And we certainly hope you will join us next time for another edition of Time Magazine. This edition is the edition for February 18th and February 25th, 2019. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And please catch our podcast for a repeat of this program and others at TriangleReadingService.org. That's TriangleReadingService.org. This is your dedicated reader, Randall Rickman, thanking once again for your patience today with your reader's errors and shortcomings, for which he apologizes and will try to make amends on our next Time Magazine.